Hello and welcome to the Catbird Speaks, the official podcast for the Baseball Prospectus local White Sox page, BP Southside. My name is Nick Schaefer. I'm here in Manhattan, New York. I'm here joined with Ethan Spaulding, who is in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's finally getting somewhat warm here, so I can't complain about the weather intro about being in Wisconsin when I'm on casts.
And miraculously, we're also joined by Kat Garcia, our one local tether to Chicago specifically. Kat, how are you?
I'm good.
Hey, I live in Chicago 3 months a year.
You don't live in Chicago. You live in Glenview.
Well, yeah.
Boom.
I will live in Chicago, hopefully, when I'm out of college in 9 months.
If we're even friends by then.
We are 55 seconds in, and we're at each other's throats. It's White Sox baseball. and this is when we're 5-2, so, you know, you can only imagine how bad it would be if things weren't going so well.
They haven't been crushingly disappointing yet. Which,
not yet, yeah.
Which is, like, this is the longest it's taken for them to be disappointing as long as I could remember. Their two losses were one against Sonny Gray, and just, like, Sonny Gray's really good, so who cares? And then one when John Danks got shelled. Even if Salazar was kind of a mess on that game, and I was at the home, that was the home opener, and I made it, I went there, and I left that game earlier than I've ever left a baseball game before. I left in the sixth inning.
Yeah, last year when Carlos Rodon came up, that was the first time I ever left a game because he didn't pitch the night he got called up, and I was like, screw this, I'm leaving in like the eighth inning. And then I'm pretty sure that game ended up being like a walk-off because the Sox were losing, if I remember correctly. Then there ended up being like a walk-off, and I was like, this is why I never, ever leave games.
Well, in your defense, see, since when would the White Sox score some runs once they already hadn't?
Yeah.
See, prior to this year. The thing with the game, they were down 6-1 when I left. And in the snow, in 32-degree weather, they were not catching up in that game.
You were a brave soul to even go to that game.
Right.
I definitely did not even want to go to that game at all. That's the first time I've missed opening day in, like, well, actually only 2 years.
But in defense,
I've gone 3 of the last 4 years. I started the first time I ever went to a home opener was, I want to say, it was my senior year of high school, I think.
Like this one.
Oh, it's my junior year in college now. So
yeah, if you round up,
yeah, it's three and 4 years for me. I went and I've been like the last 2 years. I've left early. I've left. Luckily, they've been on Fridays, so I can just hop on the mega bus from Madison to Chicago and go to the game, which has been nice. Well, it hasn't really been nice because both games have fucking blown. Last year, Hector Nwosi got the home opener, and this year, John...
that's right. Yeah, he did.
Oh, jeez. And that's crazy to think of how far they've come in a year that Hector Nwosi has just, like, been banished.
Last year, we convinced ourselves to be somewhat optimistic about Hector Nwosi.
Yeah.
Right. It was like he's got some velocity and Don Cooper's in the same room with him a couple of times a day. So
Hector Nwosi was part of why I've like come around on the theory that Don Cooper isn't a fixer, but he's a builder. Because most of the guys who you consider Don Cooper success projects aren't reclamation products. I think the best reclamation project is probably, I don't even count Quintana because he came up through the system even though he was so young when he came to the Sox. So the best reclamation project was probably Gavin Floyd. And then obviously you got Loaiza and Contreras years back.
Matt Thornton as well, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and Thornton is the most drastic because there was the specific story of Cooper having had like a note saying like, Thornton, like Seattle reliever, fixable, and had like some sort of note about his delivery. And then the instant he came over, Thornton just started shredding people.
One of the stories, though, is that the thing that Cooper said is like at some point he said to Thornton, "You don't know how to control anything, but you throw really hard, so aim down the middle and you'll get outs." And that's basically what he did.
I think it was like he needed to bend his like plant leg or something more, and that was pretty much it. And then all of a sudden it was, you know, 98 down the
best
middle.
Best lefty reliever in baseball.
for like 4 years.
Yeah, he was incredible.
He's
now it's Zach Duke. So,
I mean, Thornton was still better than Duke last year.
Yeah, he was.
But even so far this year, I mean, through 5-2, you know, you cite, yeah, you lose a game to Sonny Gray, and that just happens. You lose 2-1. Rodon pitched a great game. But even that game, like, you know, hat tip to Gray and all that. But, you know, they got guys on base. It wasn't...
they got four walks on Sonny Gray. Even if they didn't capitalize on that, four walks against Sonny Gray is not anything to scoff at.
Yeah, they were definitely working the counts, which, I mean, that's great to see.
Is this just what we should have expected from basically what they have put in for several years now? If you have like a competent offense and a competent defense, this is just the rest will take care of itself.
Well, see, I don't know if the defense is competent yet. I think it's fine. Jimmy Rollins scares me at short. He has no range at all.
Right.
He's like late career Derek Jeter there.
But mistake, you know, if you have mistake-free low range, isn't that sort of like the definition of competence? Isn't that what that would
mean? Not when you're at the hardest defensive position on the field.
Oh, like, I mean like collectively, not just Rollins. Yeah, no, Rollins is. I want to get to Rollins because he does
scare me. Austin Jackson Hawk talks about this a lot, and he's not right about a lot of things, but he's dead on when he's talking about what Austin Jackson represents as a defensive player. Not even getting into his offense, which has looked awesome so far this year, but his, like, as a center fielder, he not only is probably plus in center field, but he also moves Adam Eaton, who was not graded by defensive metrics as even good at center field. Like, he was still a center field quality player. Like, that's a guy you can throw in center field comfortably. Now you got a center field type player playing right and a center field type player, a good center fielder playing center, and your outfield is just that much better. And Melky goes from being like, it goes from having two statuesque players flanking a kind of okay center field in Eaton to two really good defensive players in two-thirds of the outfield, and then you can kind of get away with the fact that Melky doesn't have great range, but he doesn't really make mistakes, and he has a solid arm. Like, makes the outfield really, really good, actually, I think.
Yeah, because then if you have a left fielder without great range, you know, Eaton is going to get great jumps in right, and
he looks awesome out there.
I think, and it wouldn't surprise me if he had better reads in right than he does in center. I mean, if that was an issue for him, because I think that the metrics were sort of, and even the visual results were a little underwhelming for what you would expect from Eaton. And maybe it was just a matter of, you know, the occasional, the read off the bat in center is just harder than.
I do think that having two players as bad defensively as Avisail and Melky to each of your sides as a center fielder is going to hurt any but the greatest center fielder.
Absolutely. It's going to drag you down. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that Melky is now, instead of being like, you know, having to be the second best outfielder of the group, you know, if I were Austin Jackson, I would shade to my right and try to pick up some of the slack for Melky, trusting the fact that I've got a center fielder to my left. And then Melky can just take advantage of having a plus arm where he is. And
there are good defensive teams that have bad left fielders. Left field is where you put your worst fielder, other than first base. Like, it's totally fine that they have a bad left fielder when they have the center. You don't need to be the Royals, especially not in the Cell. The Cell doesn't have a big outfield. And the Sox have played in so far this year. Obviously Oakland is a big outfield, and they looked fine out there. But, like, the Cell is such a small outfield that Jackson and Eaton are going to cover so much ground, so much percentage of that ground of non-home run balls, that it should work really well, I think.
I'm on board.
Yeah.
And you know, Frazier is – I suppose we could just dive in on Rollins. I mean, obviously he picked two excellent times for his extra base hits. I don't think that's a sustainable –
he's got to get out of the two hole. Like,
Ethan hates that so much.
Obviously right now, I mean, his OPS is what, like 500 or something like that. It's
Tyler Saladino-esque.
Right. How do you guys see the next couple months playing out for Rollins at this point, from, you know, what little you've seen?
Ethan. Well, go ahead.
No, you go.
Fine. I think he will be fine offensively eventually for a shortstop. And yeah, the defense isn't even good. It's bad. His shortstop defense is bad. It's okay if he hits, like, I don't know, a 700 OPS or so, like a little bit above that. You really can't have a guy who even a good year from Rollins that helps the White Sox is probably a sub 700 OPS or a sub 300 OBP.
Mm-hmm.
Or right around there. You can't have that guy hitting second. You have Eaton, who's a mid 300s, 350, 360. And if you take off April last year, he's in like a 380 OBP for all of last year. And then you've got your power hitters in Abreu and Frazier hitting third and fourth, obviously. So why are you putting this guy who just doesn't get on base at that type of rate? You're not bunting with that guy, and you shouldn't be bunting because you should just be getting on base. I don't know who necessarily is the perfect two-hitter on this team. Melky Cabrera might be the best fit, but there are reasons why you wouldn't want Melky Cabrera hitting second. He's slow. He's not a super high OBP guy, though. So far this year, it's been nice. He hasn't struck out once.
Right, if you prioritize contact skills, then obviously he's the guy to do it. I do have concerns about the fact that the superficial things that a manager might use to justify his decisions. You know, Rollins double the other day. I think that was against Cleveland on Saturday, where he just dropped the bat head and they were shifting hard on him. And I think Jackson had led off with a single, and then Rollins sprayed a double into left field off of the. He just went the other way with it, and it was the type of thing where a manager can say, "Aha! Look, here's my two hitter. He has bat to ball skills, and he's experienced, and he can do things like that in that sort of situation." And similarly, how Avisaíl had his big home run, and that's sort of the only thing propping up the entire week for him. You take those two things, and that's enough for a manager like Ventura to just say, hey, look, I can point to these things and justify my decisions.
I hope he's smarter than that. I hope there's someone in the dugout who's saying, don't do that. Avisaíl has six strikeouts and seven extra base, or seven base, like total bases this year.
Like, and that's four of those are on one swing.
And four of them are on one swing, and then he has three singles because he only hits singles, and then the occasional home run.
It's not just like, you know, Austin Jackson. If you watch every bat, I mean, because Austin Jackson right now is OPS is 623. That's not great, right? But like, he's like hit the ball hard a few times and had not work out. I mean, Avisaíl looks possibly worse than his line even indicates. His line is terrible. Like, he has no idea what the pitcher's throwing. He has no situational like plan. And his swing is this sort of, have you guys ever seen someone do this like half awkward swing that he does as often as he does? It's incredible.
He swings over every single pitch.
Yeah.
He swings through everything. It's insane how much he swings through pitches. Like,
mm-hmm.
It reminds me of a very big Gordon Beckham at the plate.
Oh God.
I wish he struck out more, though, because like, he puts his bat on the ball in these situations where it's like, you would have been better just swinging and missing. Like, if he had more conviction with what he did, I'd rather he just sold out for power and like closed his eyes and like swung as hard as he could instead of doing the tentative, like, terrible contact thing. Because he has this weird, like, he has just enough of a bat-to-ball skill to, like, make terrible outs.
Yeah.
No, it's. I mean, he's the kind of guy you would like. Just look at his ISO last year. He had a 108 ISO, which was the same isolated power, which is a slugging percentage minus batting average. He had this, which is a good measure of power. He had the same isolated power as Carlos Sanchez last year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's definitely not good.
I mean, Carlos Sanchez has hit some dingers, though. Like, there was that one game where he hit two dingers. That was cool. But, honestly, Carlos Sanchez might be a better DH at this point than Avisail Garcia.
He's younger.
I think any of us would be a better DH at this point than Avisail Garcia.
I actually, I was at a fantasy draft on Sunday, and somebody picked Avisail really late because it's a really deep draft. And I couldn't even help myself. I just said, I think Avisail might be the worst player I've ever seen.
No. He's not. Who was the guy that the Sox had in 07 that was just like, he had like a -10 weighted run created plus. I think it was like, was it Andy Marte?
Andy Gonzalez.
Oh.
Andy Gonzalez.
You got to be more specific though. I was going to say like 2007.
No, Andy, for a terrible year that 2007 was, Andy Gonzalez was particularly bad, like standout bad. Him and Aaron Wasserman.
Yeah, but there was also like
Wasserman.
Alex Cintron was just as bad. And
no, Alex Cintron was not as bad as Andy Gonzalez.
No, he definitely wasn't.
They had the same because on base.
Alex Cintron actually stuck around in the majors after that.
Yeah.
After that? Before that?
Before that. In 07, I guess Andy Gonzalez right. wasn't as bad as I remember. He wasn't even as bad as Leury Garcia was in 13.
Oh,
apparently, Leury Garcia was the worst player I've ever seen.
But the thing is, Leury Garcia, you can say, okay, this dude can't hit, right? But, like, he can play every position, including pitcher, apparently.
Right.
So, with movement on his fastball.
What does Avisail have to offer? Like, there's zero things he does well.
I bet Avisail would actually be a decent position player pitcher. I run 70 mile per hour fastball, the count that gets that alerts people to position players pitching.
Right.
I bet Avisail Garcia would not be a 70 mile per hour fastball. I bet he'd be maybe even a high 80 mile per hour fastball.
I could see him going 83, 85, and it wouldn't surprise me if he went.
Alexa hit 88.
Yeah.
Alexa has been clocked by StatCast at 97 at shortstop, but that's with like getting to run into his throw.
Apparently Puig hit 89 from the outfield today without like setting himself.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Not a running throw last year got clocked at 100.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is Eaton had a huge arm before he got hung up with injuries.
And then he was traded because people were scared his arm wouldn't come back. It's coming back. He's got a right fielder's arm.
Yeah.
Like we're diverging on the topic again, but I think Adam Eaton could be good right field defense version of Brett Gardner. Like Brett Gardner is really good as a left fielder, mm-hmm. but he's got no arm. Like there's a reason why he's a left outfielder. If I think Eaton could be that good defensively and right with a good arm, which is like Jason Hayward.
Right? I knew you. I was waiting for you to say that.
I mean, I think Jason Hayward is like a historically good defensive corner outfielder, and I don't think Eaton's going to be that.
Mm-mm.
But I also think Eaton's a better hitter than Jason Hayward. So
here's my question, though, like in terms of combining this sort of Avisail corner outfielder question together. And, you know, obviously they've just got Avisail out there at DH, and we've talked about how Melky can kind of hang in there if you're not counting on him being the second best defensive outfielder. But, like, at a certain point, if you're running Avisail out there every day at DH and he just keeps, you know, adding data points to this, like, this dude cannot play in MLB. At what point do you just do a Shuck, like, sans platoon in left and put Melky at DH? Like, where is the tipping point?
What have done that, yesterday.
Where that decision becomes, like, the objectively correct decision. I mean, I would do it now because I think that chasing Avisail, capitalizing on his whatever potential you think is there is fruitless at this point. But
yeah, I think that tipping point came a while ago, which makes me scared to think about when the White Sox see that they're going to reach it, because they just keep giving him. I understand that he didn't have, you know, the full season and everyone wanted to see him develop without injuries and all that, but I just feel like it's not working and we're wasting time, but the White Sox are not seeing that.
For a team that right now they're 5-2, so they're like, which obviously it's very early in the year, but it's banking those, like, it's 5-2. You're 3 games over 500 in the book already. Like, for a team that's median projections were somewhere around like 82, 83 wins, you now have 5 wins and 2 losses in the book. So if the true talent of this team hasn't changed, now your median projections are probably up from 82 to 84, 85 wins. For a team to like be right in that range and still be throwing out one of the worst regulars in baseball every day, mm-hmm. It's a problem. Like, cause you are right in the range right now where adding a win makes you 10 to 20% more, or I don't know if maybe like 10 to 15% more likely to win the division.
And, like, and obviously, like, the Twins were not the, you know, one of the main threats, but they had a non-zero chance of competing this year, right? I mean,
now they have a zero. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So yeah. I know that it's only been a week, and I don't want to overstate 6 or 7 games.
No, they sucked, and they sucked, and now they, like, they already sucked, and now they lost 7 games. So they're not going to make the playoffs.
It does matter, though, that, like, a team that had a 5 to 10% chance of winning the division or whatever has just gone to zero, right? Like, that, some of that spills over to the White Sox, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
If you look at the BP, if you look at the Pecota standings, and I do question, I brought this up with the stats slack. The Sox have added 15% to their playoff percentage so far this year, which is a lot. Mm-hmm. That magnitude seems too much to me, but it can be explained very much by what you were saying at the Twins. It spills over to the White Sox, and it probably spills over to the Indians, and it doesn't spill over to the Royals by Pecota, because Pecota thinks the Royals suck. I think Pecota is likely wrong about the Royals. I think that the Royals do something that we are not good enough at measuring yet. And I think a lot of it has to do with relievers.
Yeah.
And I think, but that said, having your overall point about the Twins is correct. Like, the Twins basically now have no chance of making the playoffs. Like, they were a bad team going into this year.
Mm-hmm. But they weren't so bad that they were, like, irrelevant.
No, right. They definitely weren't, no.
Well, there were some people who, for some reason, thought that they were good enough to win the division.
No, but that's definitely not a thing. They were horrible.
But there was a not completely crazy idea or possibility of them doing kind of well enough to at least make waves in the division. Like, if Buxton completely broke out and if Sano continued hitting, like, right.
Their lineup is strong. Their starting pitching is not, although Ricky Nolasco, that last start, I mean, he pretty much dominated for being Ricky Nolasco. Their bullpen's really good. So they kind of have the argument there a little bit. It's not like they're just flat out trash.
No, if you look at it, like, there was a very conceivable argument where if you're looking at just power, like just looking at, like, home runs, for example, like Dozier, Plouffe, Sano.
Yeah, that middle, their heart of the order is substantial. I mean, it's got some power. It's got some power.
And, like, Park could hit some home runs. He hasn't looked good
Park
so far, but obviously,
awful.
Of all the people in that lineup who have a chance to adjust, like Buxton and Park are the guys with the best excuse, certainly.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Well, so, I'm sure. I still think Sano is going to be a monster. I could see him hitting 35, 40 home runs this year, even though he's been terrible. But I think he has something like the second lowest fly ball percentage in baseball right now, which is really bizarre for a hitter like that.
Sano,
yeah, that is.
Yeah, Sano. Or it's somewhere near the bottom of the league. Like, he's hit, like, exclusively ground balls, which is bizarre. But, like we were saying, like, they were, I picked them last, and most people who were smart picked them in the bottom 2 of the division.
Right. paired with whatever other team you felt like whose flaw was.
Right. But the Central is bunched up enough that, like, it was there was a 90th percentile outcome of the Twins that featured them doing well. Now, even if you assume that their talent is, like, even if you assume the prior distribution of their talent coming into the year is correct, and that 90 win, or that good win potential is still there for the rest of them, they've already banked 7 losses. Yeah. Like, you might have thought, if you thought they were a 90 win true talent, or let's say this team is a 90 win true talent team. Well, 90 wins is what, a 570 win percentage? I am doing math.
Oh, are you going to multiply it out across 155 games?
Yeah, 90 is a 585 winning percentage. If they were a 90 win true talent team, they'd only win, and they're not, but if they were, their median projection would be 86 wins now, which probably is going to win this, like, or not, which is probably like second place in this division.
Could be a wild card.
If they're a 90-win team and they're not. So that you're basically, if they're an 81-win team, they're going to win, what, 70?
No, you just go.
77 of their, like, they'll be, if they're a 500 team, their median projection is 77 wins. Like, they are basically fucked. Like, yep. They're not winning this league, this division. No. And that probability totally goes, it goes to the rest of the division. And the rest of the division has done really well so far this year. The Sox are 5-2. The Royals, they were winning last time I checked, and I assume
they're still up 3-2 in the eighth. It's not over yet, but you know.
Wade Davis is coming in, so it's over.
Yeah, it's over.
It's the eighth. Soria's still got to get 3 outs. So.
Oh yeah.
Oh, well, that's questionable.
Against Springer, Correa, and Rasmus. So we'll see.
If Soria, tangentially, if Soria isn't like an ace or a close to ace reliever, that hurts them a lot, and he hasn't looked good so far this year.
No, he really hasn't.
Well, that's when you were talking about how the Royals do things that aren't being captured by the projection systems. You know, I agree with you. I do think, you know, I've just certainly underestimated them over the last couple of years in terms of how things have turned out. I still think that their margin for error is, you know, given that they're given this like ephemeral, disproportionate bonus based on their collective effect, like of how the whole roster works together, I still think that they are therefore disproportionately susceptible to injury or underperformance.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. And one of the things is like, look at their team last year and look at the team they're bringing back. Who from that team has a year that you expect, like, he's definitely going to be this good again this year?
Like, if Kane doesn't get hurt, he probably does that again. If Gordon doesn't get hurt, he can probably do better than last year because he was hurt last year. Hosmer and Moustakas are just kind of what they are.
Kane's definitely a top 4 or 5 player in baseball again, and that's what he was last year. Mm-hmm. Like, I could reasonably say top 15, but last year he was incredible. Like, I don't know if he's that hitter. Like, that's his absolute...
Oh, his bat? Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, that's a fair point. I think that Moustakas and Hosmer are just basically like average to above average third baseman. That's kind of what they are. Escobar is a glove only. Second base is still a black hole for them. Right field is still a black hole for them. Their rotation is terrible, plus whatever Ian Kennedy does. And Volquez, I guess, is randomly throws 97 now. In his
mid-30s. I don't get that, but he has been pitching like a low number 2, high number 3 for the last like month of last year and so far this year.
Very strange. But to that end.
Like that team doesn't scream 95 win team. Like, I think they're better than their Pecota projections, but yeah, so like back to the original point, like they've done well, so they haven't lost anything on the Sox yet, and if they finish this game off, they will be tied with the Sox. And obviously looking at watching standings isn't super important, but the Sox, the Tigers, like the Sox, despite their hot start, the Sox haven't been able to bank wins against any team versus any of the teams they're competing against, except the Indians to an extent, but no team has, like, except for the Twins, has like already dug themselves in a hole. Like, the White Sox last year totally dug themselves in the hole within seven games, because they were, what, 1-6?
Terrible like that.
Like, they were already four games out of first place by then, and they were already fringe contenders. So they, like, that totally screwed them. None of the AL Central teams that I expected to contend have done that yet.
And Trump, like, what's troubling to me too is you know, and you know, again, like, I appreciate, you know, one of the best things I think I wrote was talking about small samples with the Nationals in the playoffs the other year. But, like, with that asterisk standing, I do think that seeing that Victor Martinez is hitting the ball well starting this year, because he's the type of guy where, like, if he were dead, I think we would see it. Right away.
I totally
Victor Martinez, like, killing the ball out of the gate is a problem, because that was one of the variables that, where it's like, if Victor Martinez is healthy and still has anything left in the tank, like, he's like,
right, that can be dangerous.
And Anibal Sanchez didn't look like garbage either.
Yeah, he was topping out at 91, but he was, I mean, the Pirates lineup is freaking good, man. And he,
no, like, and he didn't look like 2.5 ERA 2013 Anibal Sanchez, but he looked good. Like, mm-hmm. And Verlander looked like shit yesterday.
Yes, he
but
did.
He looked, yeah, good, he did.
Like,
but the Verlander Tigers
did not
have,
look
the,
like Justin. Like,
the Tigers have enough dudes where if, like, their questionable guys break right, that could be a difference maker in a division where you have four teams that should win anywhere between 80 and 90 games, and it's anybody's guess. Like, part of that is if Victor Martinez is hitting well, and if Anibal Sanchez is, like, hanging in there as, like, a number three or four starter, then all of a sudden I'm revising my estimation of the Tigers upwards.
Yeah, I'm feeling bad about my I think Tigers suck projection.
Well, I was definitely feeling bad about sleeping on them this year, because it's just, like Nick was saying, it can go either way, and if they're all healthy and they're all producing well, then that's going to go the wrong way for the White Sox.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, Victor Martinez's knees could explode at any time. You know, Kinsler is like mid-30s second baseman. Miguel Cabrera's broken down over the course of several years. That's why losing Justin Upton to the Tigers specifically was such a killer, because he's like, this such a steady presence,
right? Yeah,
amongst those other wild variables. I mean, I don't know that Gerald Saltomaki is going to keep his OPS above 900 for the rest of the year. We'll see. But
that Tigers catching situation, McCann just went on the DL.
Yeah, he did.
The Tigers, even if Victor Martinez is good, even if Anibal Sanchez is good,
if Verlander's bad, that's
going to be a problem.
Verlander looked like old Verlander last year. Like, not peak old Verlander, but he, like, things were working like they hadn't in a long time for him.
I think I understand what you mean, but you could have just meant a lot of different things, because old Verlander could mean several different things.
There's so many different things.
Yeah, I mean, like, Verlander of old, not old Verlander.
Justin Verlander looked really good down the stretch last year.
Yes, he looked like a really, like, a maybe not top of the league pitcher, but a very solid number two type starter.
Right.
Then they added Zimmerman, which I thought was a good contract. I don't think he's the pitcher he was in Washington. Like, I think he's more of the pitcher he was in 2015 than the pitcher he was from, like, 2013 and 2014, where he was, like, a borderline one, probably a high end two. I think he's $100 million is a lot of money, but there's a reason why he got $100 million and not $200 million like the real high end pitchers
did.
And
the Tigers have had success. I mean, Victor Martinez initially was brought in. Like, the Tigers have a couple of times jumped the market where they said, we're going to grab the third or fourth best guy for the rate that we think is fine, and you guys can fight over the 1, 2, and 3 guys.
And that's what they did with Upton before Cespedes signed, too. And that Upton deal is still, like, I still can't believe they got Justin Upton that money. That was such, like, obviously Upton's not a superstar. Like, he hasn't had a really, really good year probably since 2011, mm-hmm. when he was just an incredible hitter. But he's still a really damn good player. He's consistently been 20-30% above league average offensively for most of his career.
Right, yeah, he's consistently good, which is something that you want to bank on.
And he's still young, and
he'll probably opt out.
Yeah, well, he'll opt out if he doesn't opt out, the Tigers are in trouble.
Are screwed, yeah.
Because it's not that the money is too much on the back end of that deal, but if he doesn't opt out, it means he didn't do well.
Right,
because that, exactly. It's such a cheap deal otherwise that, yeah. But that said, even then, it's not a terribly expensive deal on the back end, and the Tigers are fucked for those years anyway. They're going to be paying...
They really are, yeah.
They're going to be paying like $60 million combined to Miggy and Verlander till like...
Yeah, I went over that in that Dave Dombrowski piece I did for Hardball Times, how everything just turns into a colossal clusterfuck in a couple of years for the Tigers as far as contracts go.
I mean, I wonder even if Miggy looks terrible. Get married,
oh, yeah.
These contracts up.
I mean...
Like, I'm 20 right now, so I'm well off.
Look, I know I won't even be married before these contracts are up, so.
Well, I can't comment because it'll spoil things, even though Jane doesn't listen to this podcast.
We already know. We know. You told us in the Slack.
Whoa. All right. Zipper. This is
you probably... really have to make sure she doesn't listen to this podcast now.
Or yeah, she won't. She won't. But
just edit that out.
So, yeah, but no, I will say,
Jordan's through 2023, so I'll be 27, which probably still pretty young to get married. But
do you think? All right, so, do you think there's anything to the fact that I've always liked Jordan Zimmermann as a pitcher? But do you think there's anything to the fact that last year, like 50-something% of his starts were against Braves and Phillies and like Padres and Mets before they added major leaguers in the second half, like? Is there anything to the fact that Jordan Zimmermann like took a significant step backwards last year in terms of his run prevention and his peripherals against like significantly worse competition?
And his velo totally dipped too.
Because Phillies and Braves last year, like those should be like, and like Marlins post Stanton, like most of his starts last year, if you look at his game log for 2015, a lot of those opponents are like, yeah, he had a great start against the Blue Jays in June, like fantastic. But I don't know, man. Like there is this potential for. I mean, a starter only throws 30-33 games at most, and if you're in the NL and you're in the NL East and you're on one of the two good teams, there's a very real chance for the distribution to be against a lot of abysmal opponents.
Are you saying it's unfair to say Noah Syndergaard is better than Chris Sale right now because he's striking out a bunch of horseshit players?
Oh, I don't want it. Don't make me choose between Sale and Syndergaard.
The fact that Syndergaard has made it a conversation is insane. Like, he's so good, but I still take Sale.
Obviously, I take Sale for rational and irrational reasons, but Syndergaard is like a sea monster regardless.
Yeah, there might be no one in baseball with better stuff than Syndergaard. You're not supposed to be able to throw the pitches he does as hard as he does,
and with like he commands them as well. I mean,
right? So. Yeah, no, he's. I think he's walked two batters on the year so far.
And this, I guess this is a good opportunity to plug BP Mets. I think Jared over there had like an article about Syndergaard adding pitches as well, which like he totally didn't need to do, but he did.
The ludicrous thing with Syndergaard. Slider. Well, so Syndergaard does a 95 mile an hour slider, and like people have said, Chris Sale's slider is one of the best sliders in baseball. Syndergaard throws his slider on average 10-13 miles an hour faster than Sale throws his slider. That's not even the same pitch. Those are two completely
different.
Yeah, that's
definitely pitches. Not in the slider category then.
Well, I think people have said, and it like you can't prove it because people talk about how J.R. Richard threw a slider that hard, like back in the late 70s, early 80s.
That's the guy who was really good, and then he had a stroke, and then he like ended up homeless, right?
Yeah, he was like Inner Circle Hall of Fame, and then he had a stroke on, I don't know if he was on the mound when it happened, but
I think he was, and then he, and people didn't believe him or something.
Yeah, and like, ask me whether race played into that at all, but
absolutely did.
I mean,
and then a couple years ago, someone just found him under a bridge, like homeless.
J.R. Richard, at age 30 in 1980, had an ERA of 1.9, and he did not pitch again in the majors. Like, you tell me. Like, that's insane. He struck out 303 and 313, and then in the next year after that, in 1980, he had struck out 119 in 113 innings, and then he never pitched again.
Yeah.
That's the only dude I've heard who's, like, heard of who, as a starter, threw as hard as Syndergaard. He was, J.R. Richard was 6'8". But, yeah, so. Syndergaard. I didn't mean to go all bleak there, but.
No, I mean, I've actually seen that comp thrown on. I've seen people talk about that, but J.R. Richard also had a career walks per nine of 4.3, and obviously very different era. It's almost impossible to compare, but Syndergaard doesn't walk anyone. But neither does Chris Sale. Chris Sale last year had a K per nine of over of 11.95 and a walk per nine under 2, and those numbers have only been matched or any no one the only pitchers in history to have over 11 Ks per nine, under 2 walks per nine, and over 200 innings pitched are Sale in 2015, Kershaw in 2015, and Pedro twice and Pedro did it against the peak steroid era, but so that's why. I asked the question, how many pitchers would you take over Syndergaard right now? And a couple of people said only maybe on Sale. And I think that's ludicrous because, like, Syndergaard has had two amazing starts so far this year. And over his and then the Mets announcers cited a stat, like, over his last six starts, he's struck out over his last six starts, he's struck out, like, 67 batters or something like that. And Chris Sale, over an 8-start stretch, struck out 97 batters.
Well, but, I mean, the only person who rolled with Sale's six, whatever that stretch was, and was that June, July?
Yeah.
Is Strasburg did that in his return after the DL last year.
Yeah, but it wasn't that good.
It
wasn't that good. No one struck out that many batters in an 8-start stretch other than Pedro and Sale.
Yeah, like, I know that you've got, like, the specific endpoints, but, like, the net result was kind of the same. I'm going to pull it up in a second. I do want to ask Kat specifically, too, before we go full freeform, like, sweet pitcher chat, which I guess we've kind of already done. Kat, like, you know, the offense completely turned over from last year. There's, like, a 55% turnover surrounding, like, Avisail as, like, the sad holdover, and then you have, like, Eaton and Abreu and Melky as the good to great holdovers. So, like, I don't know if you have any specific reactions after a week of watching Laurie, Frazier, Jackson, and Rollins. Like, is there any particular, like, thoughts that you have on those four dudes?
Yeah, it was actually interesting because every time, if I'm not watching the game and I just look at, you know, the summary of scored hits, lately, it's always been one of the new guys. So to me, I'm noticing that this offense has definitely been picked up by those specific guys, especially Frazier and Laurie. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like they're always, you know, making contact and I'm not elaborating on what I'm trying to say very well here, but it just seems like they're picking up the brunt of the work this year and that these deals might actually end up working out as opposed to the way they didn't in 2015.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see, you know, on Twitter interacting with people, the sort of gun-shy nature people have, because after 2015, they added a few guys, and most of them didn't work out, like, to a sort of jarring degree, where
LaRoche
obviously didn't work out, like, Melky was terrible last year, and Zach Duke has obviously looked terrible, and so people have said, well, the White Sox had a lot of people in 2015, it was bad, and now they've had a lot of people again, so who cares?
But they specifically targeted their needs, and they did it well this offseason.
I agree. I agree with that. I mean, Frazier and Laurie have had mixed results so far in terms of like if you just look at their year long stats, it's really strange because like so far in a way they've changed the character of the team, in the sense that they've had timely hitting and competent defense. So, Ethan wants to chat more about. I'd actually pulled up those. So Strasburg over his last 66 innings had 92 strikeouts and 8 walks, for an ERA of 1.9, which I do think is Sale-esque.
Sale did that against the you were just talking about.
Oh yeah,
we're obviously comparing extremes here. Like they're both so good, but Sale did that against the American League.
Yep.
And he did it. He didn't do it in September, which is when most teams are, especially in that National League East, are totally mailing it in. I mean, obviously the Strasburg stretch is amazing, but Sale had 97 strikeouts and 8 starts. He had
I'm Sale's. I love Sale so much. I do think that with Strasburg, I take a little more seriously than with a guy like Zimmerman, where Strasburg actually has the raw stuff, where it's like, hey, if he doesn't have like a huge knot in his neck and he's just throwing, you know, unimpeded, he's like, I'm trying to think of guys who can roll with Sale, and it's like guys like Strasburg when he's like completely on.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Like Syndergaard, guys like
Strasburg, when he came up, is probably the best pitcher of stuff I've ever seen. Like his start against the Pirates was the most disgusting, just display of incredible dominance. He was hitting 97, 98 on fastballs with incredible life. His slider, yeah, it wasn't Syndergaard fast, but it was moving so much more than Syndergaard could throw. Like, it put guys like Sale and Kershaw at their peak to shame, and that's how good it was.
Yeah.
I mean, well, the reason why it's relevant is because Syndergaard is the guy who, like, reminds me the most of pre-injuries Strasburg.
I could see that, yeah.
I want to say that Syndergaard reminds me more of very early Felix Hernandez.
Interesting.
Because very early Felix Hernandez was throwing that high 90s two-seamer with incredible life, and his changeup is still ungodly, but back then it was going so fast. Felix has never been a big slider guy, but that stuff was just so electric, and I see more of that than I see. I mean, obvious guys like Syndergaard are basically unprecedented. And just like Jose Fernandez was unprecedented when he was doing his stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There was a day where Paul Boye and I were just watching a pre-injury Jose Fernandez start, and just like sputtering in, you know, rewinding over and over again, watching
his just filthy.
His like 98 mile an hour two seamer is like on the outside.
Yeah. Game.
So at this point, like in terms of, I guess there's like the short term and then the next few months. I mean, like I expected Rollins to, or I still expect Rollins to be like a solid placeholder. Do you, given that, you know, over the first week, Rollins is like a zero on offense and his range is so limited. Are you guys, I guess there's two questions when it comes to the White Sox, because there's like what they should do and what they will do. And those two things are often like,
Very different. Yeah.
What do you think, like, they should do with shortstop, and what do you think they will do? Like, how much leash is Rollins going to get before they go to Saladino, and then how much, like, leash does he get?
Well, knowing the White Sox, they're going to give him a good go out there at shortstop, and I feel like he's going to be the starting shortstop for most of the season, and they're only going to put in Saladino, you know, when Rollins needs rest and situations like that, regardless of how poor he's hitting or how well Saladino's hitting, because we know how loyal the White Sox can be. That's just, yeah. I don't know.
Well, also, I mean, it's not like Saladino is going to be at his heels. Like, Saladino, we know what Saladino is at this point, I don't think he's at all a good hitter. And he can really field, but
Right. It's not like there's someone who has this huge disparity of talent that they're going to be, you know, putting on the bench.
But speaking of someone with a huge disparity of talent, do we know why the hell Tim Anderson's missed the last three games?
We don't, as far as I know. Somebody mentioned that. Like, I would think that if it was like, Tim Anderson tweaked his ankle, like, he'll be out for a few weeks, we would have heard about it.
Yeah.
Somebody on Twitter speculated that, and I can't remember who it was, speculated that, like, you know, he has a newborn, that hopefully everything's okay there. That would be horrifying, but it would certainly explain why we hadn't heard about it. Like, if Tim Anderson's health was fine, but there was something wrong with his infant, which is, like, makes me kind of cringe to even speculate about right. that. It makes me feel like a ghoul to even say that. But like, it's, I'm trying to think of what the scenarios are where somebody starts missing time like this and we don't get any sort of like, oh yeah, he banged his knee on his coffee table or, you know, like there's no, like there's no even like story to explain it. He's just vanished. So, and he's not the type of guy where it's like, you know, it's not.
He's not going to go Bartolo Colon, where he's missing in Venezuela because Michael Jackson died or whatever.
And it's not Johnny Manziel, where like we think he's just like, I don't know, somewhere.
No, he's by all accounts an extremely high character guy.
Yeah, so like, you know, you go down the list of possible explanations, and all of a sudden you get to this like, this terrifying possibility, but I don't know what else to attribute it to.
Yeah, I mean. They didn't play today. Our friends at Future Sox tweeted out that it does, like, because there's an information deficit with minor leagues, it could have just been an injury that we didn't know about. But the fact that the Sox didn't comment or anything it's odd. And
yeah, that leads me to believe it's nothing serious for like related to his playing.
Yeah, definitely nothing. Like, hopefully nothing serious with related to injuries. Hopefully, it's nothing that we may have speculated with regards to his family health or anything like that, because that would be just awful. But I hope this isn't something that and beyond that, like, it's probably not something that is gonna affect his long term or even this season effect on the White Sox. But I do expect he's gonna be nipping on Rollins' heels, but you don't want to rush him. At the same time, even a not ready Tim Anderson, there could probably hit like a high 280s average because of his contact ability and his speed.
Yeah, I mean, there's a chance of that. I mean, I guess there's you're banking on him hitting for an empty average, and like, frankly, if I just want a glove who's going to hit like for an empty average, you might as well just roll the dice in Saladino instead of effing with his development.
Right. But, no, I agree with that. I mean, I wouldn't, at that point, I wouldn't roll the dice to Saladino either, because that's not even an empty average. That's a 230 average. Like,
possibly. But you know what I'm saying, where you're like, well, because yeah, there's a chance, sure, that even if you think that Tim Anderson's true talent in the majors right now is 280, just by like variance, he could just as easily hit 230 with nothing.
For sure.
Right.
And then there's also the fact that, like, oh, I'm so bummed. I just looked at Matt Davidson, has struck out 9 times already.
And how many PAs?
22. So he's over 40% on game percentage again after all that. So good.
He's
good,
back to his old self.
Good object lesson in terms of the White Sox with hitting prospects and also with spring training sample sizes. Yeah, I mean, who knows? I was starting to talk myself into like, hey, maybe Matt Davidson comes up and saves us from Avisail Garcia, but and he still could. He's still good, but
yeah, you know who is current, and obviously small sample size WAR is garbage. You know who's currently fourth in baseball in WAR?
Hold on. It's probably it's dumb, right? That's why you picked it.
Well, no, it relates to the White Sox and someone they could very easily have right now.
Oh, that's sad.
Did you already look it up, Kat?
No, I didn't. I'm just saying that's sad because they could have them and they don't.
Damn.
Is it someone? It's Dexter Fowler, who was sitting right there. The Sox are very deployed on left-handed hitting talent. They have obviously Eaton, who's very good, and then they have Melky and Rollins are both switch hitters. But aside from that, they have no left-handed hitting. You know, Dexter Fowler, switch hitter.
I definitely should have been able to guess that. I was trying to think of who we were in pursuit of during, like, Sox Fest, and I couldn't think of who that one free agent was, and then I was like, God damn it, it was Dexter Fowler. And yeah, he's definitely been producing really well so far.
I mean, you could also... It's one of those things where, like, I'm happy Austin Jackson's on board.
You could have both.
I know, you could have both.
DH.
Yep, exactly. I mean, obviously, before LaRoche just, like, ghosted himself, then that made less sense. But, like, if you had signed Fowler, who knows if anyone would have actually signed Austin Jackson by the time.
And then LaRoche, the whole LaRoche thing happens. And then you got both, and you have the best, you have a Royals-esque defensive outfield if you have Fowler and Eaton and Jackson in one outfield.
You put Fowler in left, yeah.
The Cubs get him for 1 year and $13 million.
Would Fowler, Jackson, Eaton be the best defensive outfield? Or Pirates still?
There's no Lorenzo Cain or, like, there's no, like, elite defender in there, but it's also three center fielders.
I guess like the Pirates are running three center fielders similarly.
Well, aren't the Royals right now doing Cain and Jared Dyson in the same outfield?
Dyson's on the DL, isn't he?
Oh, okay. Well, they still have Alex Gordon, who is, like, incredible in left.
Yeah.
Still have Cain, and is it Paul Orlando in right then?
Probably. I mean, but we're like talking about this sort of thing, right? Like.
Right, no, it's incredible. They just don't have that guy that's like, oh my god, this guy is game changing in center.
Right.
Which is what Kane, McCutcheon probably isn't that, but Starling Marte makes up for it. Like, yep. Starling Marte is a better defender than any of the Sox potential three outfields, but this is all sad hypotheticals, and we shouldn't be sad because they are 5-2. We haven't even mentioned the fact that the pitching has been incredible so far. They're 5-7 in quality starts, and the only start that they missed a quality start other than Danks getting shelled
was a 5-2/3 for
Quintana was 5-2/3 with what, 8 Ks and no walks,
something like that.
Yeah, he had a great. Quintana's looked awesome so far. His curveball looks better than it's ever been. Oop. I just turned the game on. Wade Davis has walked 2 batters and only made 1 out. He has 20 pitches to get 1 out.
Wade Davis,
we can forget about the Royals' playoff chances.
Well, I mean, Wade Davis was an abysmal fifth starter for most of his career until, like, 2 years ago. So,
and then he had the best 2 year stretch of any reliever in that series.
Right. I mean, but Quintana's had 2 starts and in, like, horrible weather, and his velocity is, like, up. So,
and his curveball looks like an out pitch. Like, in the past, his curveball has been something that steals strikes, and now it looks like something that people swing and miss on.
And he started. It looks like he's fooling around with, like, challenging people pretty aggressively with it. Like, he's started...
Yeah, there was one inning in the Twins start that really frustrated me because he wasn't doing that against the fucking Twins. But
there were a couple innings in that same start where he was, like, throwing it out there and he was missing by, like, an inch or two. Where if he puts it on the black, like, he's unhittable. So
right. No, and if Quintana steps up this year. Like, he's already good enough. You're talking about right now, you have Sale, who hasn't been Sale yet, but he also threw one start where he was throwing to Sale, and then one start where it was 32 degrees. And, like, I'm not going to take any analysis of a pitcher in 32 degrees as definitive analysis of that pitcher. So Sale hasn't looked great. Rodon has 1 start so far and looked after those first 2 innings, just looked incredible.
Right, like, insanely efficient and, like calm and composed and, like, command of his arsenal. I mean, if Rodon, Quintana, and Sale are all, like, at, you know, at expectations or better, and if Leitos, like, I don't...
Pitched innings. Literally just pitches innings. Like, it that's all it has to be from those back two. Save the bullpen.
Yep.
Yeah.
Then, yeah. I don't know. This could be a, this could be a thing.
This, like, I know that people, like, I know that the 2015 Mets were really good, and I know they acquired Yoenis Céspedes, but I don't think it's crazy to compare this White Sox team. Like, it's obviously a high percentile outcome, but the high percentile outcome for this team looks like the 2015 Mets.
But that's what's so interesting about the 2015 Mets is that, like, the 2015 Mets ran, like, minor leaguers out there for, like, half of their lineup for a couple of months. Like, they had Eric Campbell and, like a bunch of...
Ruben Tejada and...
And like, guys worse than Ruben Tejada. Like, Ruben Tejada, you can say, like, his glove is not terrible and he can, like, take a walk. Like, there were dudes they had there. There's Eric Campbell and there's a couple other guys that they were just running out there on a day-to-day basis.
Like, they had Ligaris, and then before they brought up Conforto, who did they even have in the outfield? Ligaris, who was bad...
But they
Kadire, they had fucking Matt Kadire.
But when the Mets brought in, like, before they brought in Céspedes, them bringing in Kelly Johnson and Juan Uribe was like a big deal.
Oh, like, if the Sox had made the same trades that the Mets had at the deadline, the Sox probably would have had the same record as the Twins. They went to
They ran John Mayberry out there for 120 plate appearances. They ran
that's right,
Kirk
yeah.
Nieuwenhuis out there for.
Nieuwenhuis
for 106 plate appearances. Anthony Recker, Daryl Chesilani got 75 plate appearances. Johnny Manel, I've never heard of these freaking guys, got 52.
When Travis Darna was on the DL, they had Kevin Plawecki just look terrible.
Kadire got 408 plate appearances. Eric Campbell got 206.
And at the same time, that rotation is better than not this White Sox rotation.
Yeah, that's the thing, is it was holding down a substantial part of the fort for the Mets. I mean, when you're not allowing runs, you really don't have to have as much offense, you know, when you have that Mets rotation.
But this Sox rotation could be great. And also...
If Rodon and Quintana take a step forward, are they really that much worse than...
Oh, no. Well, if they take the step forward consistently...
You don't have Syndergaard and Mats. Like they. I think you could argue that Sale, Quintana, Rodon is reasonably close to Harvey, DeGrom, Syndergaard. But then the difference between Latos and Mats, and then even the difference between Cologne and Danks is pretty damn big.
Well, Mats only threw 35 innings in the regular
season.
Right.
I guess comparing.
Am I that crazy to say that Carson Fulmer is our Mats?
I mean, no, I don't think so. I don't think that's crazy.
Like in this blueprint, I mean.
Okay, sure. I think that's reasonable.
I mean, well, what happened with Steve Mats yesterday?
I didn't watch the outing.
I know he got Stantoned. Like, Stanton just hit a bomb.
Well, no, I just looked at the line because I know I was looking at it yesterday and I was wondering what happened. But he pitched 1.2 innings, 6 hits, 7 runs,
2 walks,
one strikeout and a home run in 1.2 innings. So.
Well, got shelled.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the same line that the Syndergaard just completely eviscerated today.
And Mats is 25 this year. I mean,
he's had 2 Tommy Johns already, I think.
He's had
really? Two?
I thought he had the one.
He's had one and then other injuries.
Yeah, he's definitely been crazy injury prone, but I thought he only had the one Tommy John.
Okay, maybe it's only one Tommy John, but there's been a lot of injuries for Mats. But even still, like, even John Neese is probably better than John Danks. So
yeah, I mean,
and the difference there too is that they weren't good until the trade deadline. Like, they were right around 500 of the trade deadline, but the rest of the division sucked too. Like, I don't think if the Sox are, yeah, the Mets ended up winning 90 games, but they were, like, I want to say 54 and 55 at the deadline, or maybe 55 and 54. They were right. They had basically the same record as the White Sox at the deadline, because if you remember, the White Sox had that weird-ass stretch where they just won a bunch of games.
Yeah, right before the deadline, and then they didn't do anything.
They got to hit against the Red Sox rotation.
Yup, yeah. That's exactly what it was.
Yeah, and So, and then they went on a crazy run. But the White Sox, when they made that run and got to that point, they were still like 6 games out of the division, or maybe even more, because the Royals were really good.
Yeah, it was substantial. It was like, this is possible, but it's not like it's going to happen tomorrow.
And the wild card looked like the bigger possibility, whereas the Mets were right there with the Nationals because they were garbage.
Right.
So the White Sox can't be 2015 Mets in the sense that this division is going to – like, this division is better than that.
But because, at the same time, the wild card is not precluded from them in the sense that it was from the Mets, because you don't have – the Cubs and Pirates winning 97 and 98 games in the freaking wild card.
Right. So I think, I think that this team's pitching is good enough that they could be like an altered edition of that Mets team. They really need to spend the $13 million they use LaRoche. It's freed up for LaRoche, and it should be early. Like, you got to be on the phone with teams like the Rockies, the Padres, the Reds.
The Reds are like 6-2, right?
Well, the Reds,
yeah, no, they are.
But Reds, point taken.
The Reds would probably be like, their fans and maybe even their players would probably lead a coup if they traded a good player now.
I know what you mean, though. Like, I'm not trying to detract from your overall argument.
No, for sure. But you got to be calling those teams like now. Like, yo, we have money. Give us Matt Kemp. We know that he costs a lot. Pay us some of that money so we don't have to fucking bet Avisel Garcia every day anymore.
I know, like, we'll send you something we won't miss.
We'll give you Spencer Adams or
Jordan Guerrero or...
Yeah, someone who, like, he might help you out. It's fine. We'll save you some money. Just please, please help us not... We'll even give you Avisel. You can see what that magic's gonna work.
Yeah,
like,
I mean, Avisel, the thing with Avisel to me is not just... I'm just not just looking at his stat line and being like, "Oh, his stats are bad."
Oh, it's watching him.
It's like, looking at play
firsthand.
Dude doesn't have a clue. He has no chance, and his swing is getting worse. Like, he has no idea what's coming. He has no plan. Like, there's no, it, like, Vicedo. I know that everybody like has been.
Vicedo hit dingers.
I know, like, that's the thing. It's like everyone's hot and cold with the Vicedo comp. But the thing is, Vicedo just, like, closed his eyes and swung as hard as he could.
Right,
and, like frankly, Vicedo, that kind of, that, like, at least that had a chance of working, because if he hit the ball, it would do something.
At least Vicedo took advantage of the one tool he had.
Yeah. Right, like, exactly. Avisel, one thing,
arguably has 4 tools that are above average.
But he doesn't use any of them. He can't translate any of them into any in-game
skill. I guess
he
sometimes uses the arm, but other than that, yeah. Like,
what's the value of a DH's arm?
True, yeah, exactly. But I meant last year in the field, he sometimes used his arm.
Right.
But I guess then Vicedo had 2 tools, not 1, because that arm was a cannon. He just often made himself have to use it because of his bad fielding. But,
okay, so what were we going to say?
I was basically just going to go, like, it's watching Avisel. So far this year, it's clear that it's not going to work.
He's not a major leaguer. He's just not.
No.
And maybe a team like the Brewers, who are running out players like Domingo Santana.
I like Domingo Santana better than Avisel.
Well, I don't know.
He can play the field. He has power. He can run. Like,
he strikes out a shit ton.
Yeah, so does Avisel.
Well, sure,
but he doesn't
sure.
do any of those other things in the meantime.
Right.
But, okay. Nonetheless, the Brewers are also running out Chris Carter. So, like, they're running out non-major league players.
Yeah, exactly. So Avi would fit right in with them.
Right. Trade Avi and Spencer Adams for Brian Braun or some shit like that.
Yeah, Brian Braun would be a very Jerry Reinsdorf player. I could totally see that.
Except
for that happening.
No, but, like, that's been – that I've talked to Craig and James about this. I don't think it's going to happen, but it's, like, there's obviously been nothing close to a rumor of it happening. I don't know if they even called the Brewers about it happening. But that has been, like, you know, like, I'd like this. It's a lot. Like,
if the Brewers, cool. if the Brewers still had Chris Davis, I'd be, like, really into that. But –
Oh, yeah.
But
– Yeah, Chris – even that, like – Like, even
but maybe Oakland, just maybe Josh Reddick would be fine. like would be great.
Yeah, but the A's are
anyone
doing
would
well.
Be better than Avi, and I'm not saying that as a joke. I'm saying that as his production's so poor that there's a lot of people that could
like,
be
legitimately
substantially better than him.
Do either of you think Avi can outperform a sans Shuck platoon?
No, because Shuck can play defense.
Yeah, and but even at like, all right, you put glove, you know, change Melky's glove for Shuck's and whatever it is, but like Sands and Shuck can at least between the two of them can probably muster an on base percentage of like 330 against like total, right?
And that's I'd be surprised if it got over 300 or like even around
you
300.
Think so?
I think 330 is a little
Shuck
ambitious.
Between the two of them.
I guess Shuck could be an empty. I think Shuck could be an is an empty OBP, and I don't really like Sands as anything.
Okay.
But
that's I mean, hey, I don't want to I'm not gonna like go to
it's
war.
It's possible
for, like,
I wouldn't
Shands,
bank on
but,
it.
Sands, but like,
330 is well above
you're right.
league average today's
right.
OBP.
I mean, and Shuck has done that a couple times, but not in like part time action. And
yeah, Shuck only had like 200 plate appearances last year. So
that's fair. And he did it, but he did it in 478 in 2013. But no, you're right. I don't want to go crazy, but that's just 330
is aggressive just because 330 is a really good on base percentage in
yeah.
That's just an example of like, but like Shuck and Sands versus Abyssal, because that's just what's in house. That's just what's available. That's just what like Ventura has decided he's opting for with Abyssal's quote upside, I guess. But before we wrap up, because we're already coming up on, an hour and 10 minutes, because you guys are just so much fun to talk. But I want to say, because we are Baseball Perspectives, I'm looking at Brukota's depth chart, and this is something that struck me today, because and the revisions on the depth chart are still pending. They're still rolling because, like, the White Sox, for example, was last updated April 1st. The Cleveland hasn't been updated since the season started. The Twins offense was just revised to April 11th, for example. But even so, the current projection on Picota with the depth charts is Cleveland winning 90 games, the White Sox in second with 82 wins, and the Tigers, Twins, and Royals
right.
with 77.
All right, let me stats talk real quick, just real quick, because so the project. One thing that I find very weird, and I talked to Harry about this, is that if you go to projected standings, it's different than playoff odds.
I would recommend
looking at the playoff odds page, which gives you a projected a sim win total and a sim loss total. That is the average of all the sims, and it has Cleveland at 88.6 and the Sox at 84.9.
Well, so here's,
but here's the thing,
I'm looking at the playoff odds page and I appreciate that, but my point is that on the depth chart it shows that it projects Cleveland to have the best defense in all of Major League Baseball. By like, it has like
best defense.
Yes, it has Cleveland at 47.8 fielding runs above average, versus or whatever it is, versus Pittsburgh is like right behind them.
Tampa and, has 57.9.
San Francisco right behind them, and
Tampa's ahead of them, but.
You're right. Tampa's number one, but it's
worth noting that fielding run above average includes framing runs, and Yan Gomes is a fantastic framer. So it's not just that they have like the it's not just that Dakota thinks that there's this irrational projection for this team. But
it thinks Lonnie Chisenhall is like
is Jason Hayward and right. Yeah, I know. I don't like. It struggles with a bunch of guys who had very small sample defensive runs. Projecting guys with very extreme values of past defensive performance in the future is very difficult. And Lonnie Chisenhall, for whatever reason, was considered a great defensive right fielder in his short time there. I don't think he's going to be that. Yeah. And watching Juan Uribe for 4 or 5 games so far this year, I don't think Juan Uribe is a plus third baseman anymore.
I mean, Lindor is fantastic in a way that not only is great at short, but in a way that we saw over the weekend, like covers for the weaknesses of some other people. Like he was like erasing errors for other people.
Oh, he's incredible. I love Francisco Lindor.
But he's one dude. And right. and like I just don't see if you're saying if you're saying that general, that defense that, is if you're saying that that defense is as good as a defense that has Marte, McCutcheon, and Polanco, like no. when you have 35-year-old Rajay Davis and like Jose Ramirez in left, like you're high, like that's just not correct.
No, the talent isn't as evenly distributed as in the type of outfield with McCutcheon and all of them. It's just like flashes of really talented guys next to guys like Juan Uribe, which
yeah. and Juan Uribe has been a really good defender for the past few years, but he's also 37.
Yeah, he's also old as shit now. He was on the World Series winning team in 2005.
Yeah, and he was old as shit.
Like he's gone to a lot of like I really wanted the Mets to win last year, not just because I fucking hate the Royals, but because I wanted to see Juan Uribe get a third ring.
Yeah,
I would have owned so much.
I'm on board.
Yeah, dude, I do love him though. I didn't mean to insult him.
No, I mean Uribe is great, but I'm just saying like if
no at 37 he's not an above average third baseman. Giovanni Urshela. Is really good defensively, but yeah, no, that's the one that of all the Pecota projections other than the Royals, that's the one that I'm just like, that doesn't pass the smell test.
There's like the Indians, I get liking the Indians, but it's for the same
reason. Oh, absolutely.
But if the difference between the White Sox and Indians per Pecota is saying that the Indians have a superlative defense, I just don't think that's true. I don't think
right. It's not. I mean, okay. If you brought the Indians' projected run value of their defense to the White Sox level, you'd be docking four wins from them. So they'd be like, by the playoff odds page, you'd be basically saying the White Sox are marginally better. And I think the Indians do have a better defense than the White Sox, if not by a lot. But it's definitely within the margin of error of a projection system. And yes, mm-hmm. I agree that Pecota thinking that the defense is that good is wrong. Royals are a 73-win team. So basically from that, what I'm getting at is that at this point, I think the White Sox are – I mean, I picked them to win the division going into this year, and I totally concede that could include some of my biases. But I think that the White Sox have – at this point, as good of a chance as any of these teams, and that makes it all the more important to spend that $13 million yep. because they are right there. I mean, the Tigers are probably like if Anibal Sanchez is like we talked about earlier. If Anibal Sanchez is back, if Victor Martinez is back, the Tigers are better than what their projections are going to look like because they have and definitely better than what I thought they were. Yeah. And obviously, it's way too early to declare those guys back, but they might be, and they don't look dead, which they looked last year.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, that's what scares me. So,
and that would put the Tigers right there with the White Sox, who are right there with the Indians, who are right there with the Royals. And
then yeah, everything's kind of too close to call, I feel like.
And that makes acquiring even a Jay Bruce, even a, I don't know, like some... like a slightly below league average player,
a freaking Seth Smith, like something.
Fucking Ryan Howard would produce better than Avisail Garcia.
All you need is a DH. All you need is a DH who could OPS like 750 to 800,
which is sad because you should have a DH who's better than that, especially in a contending team. But
they don't. Avisail looks that freaking bad, man.
Yo, let's bring back Adam Dunn. Like, I don't care.
Yeah.
Adam sure produced better than I'm sure
I'm
of that.
Serious. That's the thing.
Yeah.
The one thing is you're really not gonna find, unless some teams shot like very much underperform, there's not gonna be guys who are rental players available at the deadline at the trade deadline. You have, like, the best free agents are all two guys that are coming from Batista. At this point, you're not getting Pedro Alvarez from the – that would have been a nice signing, by the
actually,
way.
Actually, I mean, it's Nate Bernhardt was saying that the Orioles – because if you look at it, The Orioles are running out Trumbo, Chris Davis, and Pedro Alvarez. They don't have room for all those dudes.
For sure. Yeah, they could move someone, but they're probably not going to move someone who might be contending for a wild card spot with them.
Yeah.
But that said, like, look at the potential designated hitters on the free agent market next year. It's guys like Beltran, Encarnacion, Adam Lind, Kendrys Morales, Brandon Moss, Carlos Santana. These guys are all on contenders.
Yeah.
They're not guys who are going to get moved.
Maybe the Cardinals, you could, like, maybe one of their left-handed.
Right, maybe you could get Matt Adams from the Cardinals when Peralta gets back. They might just have a roster crunch and they want to keep Ruben Tejada.
And they might need an arm. I mean, I know they've got a million guys, but Marco Gonzalez just went down as well. And if Jaime
Garcia, I don't trust Walker's shoulder holding up at this point.
And freaking Jaime Garcia, dude. Like, you think he's going to hang in there? Like,
I don't. They might not be a contender this year. They might get run over by the Cubs and the Pirates.
They should.
I definitely think. Well, I shouldn't say definitely because Cardinals.
They're the Cardinals. Magic. You never want to say definitely about.
But
them.
No, there are substantial questions that you can pose for them.
I mean, then you're talking about guys like Holiday maybe hitting the trade market, but those are guys that are coming available late, very late. And the Sox really need someone who's going to be available in mid-May at the latest.
Yeah.
They cannot afford to have Avisail Garcia playing every day, and they don't really have any other options.
Is that, in a sense, does it matter a lot that the Reds started out 5-2?
It hurts. It does hurt because that they're not going to, like, last year the Braves traded Craig Kimbrel on opening day. Like, if the Braves had started out 7-2 and then traded Craig, they wouldn't have traded Craig Kimbrel. And the same thing probably can be said about the Reds. So it's their willingness to trade Bruce is probably not going to be super high for at least a couple of weeks until the Cubs just run them to the dirt. And there's like the bats that are available. They're just not, it's not going to be super deep. The guy that makes a lot of sense still, and he obviously was connected to the Sox throughout the offseason, is Carlos Gonzalez.
But
by all accounts, the Rockies are asking for the world for him. I do like now, like, there was reasons during the offseason why I was against acquiring Carlos Gonzalez. I thought that a guy like that might be risks acquiring a guy like that because of his splits and he's not a great defender, etc. But now that you got Austin Jackson and you don't need that guy to be your best defender, and you can move that guy into left-handed power bat, probably going to hit, even if he's not going to hit 40 bombs at the cell, he's probably going to hit his fair share.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a guy who would be a really, really, really good fit. And the Rockies, they are off to a 3-4 start, but they're so weird with how they decide to trade players. Like, they're like, we'll never trade Tulo, we'll never trade Tulo, and then they trade Tulo for a really weak package.
Yeah, like taking Reyes back with his money, and like, that's weird, freaking weird.
And Jeff Hoffman is the frontline prospect, and Hoffman's cool. Hoffman could be really cool, and the Rockies farm system good, but like, and then they're apparently asking for two top prospects and full salary relief, and you're not for Carlos Gonzalez, and you're not going to trade, even let's say Tim Anderson's off limits, but you're not going to trade Carson Fulmer and Spencer Adams and take all of Carlos Gonzalez's money for a 30-year-old left fielder. He's 30 now. And then, yeah, so I'm sure guys like that will emerge even after April, because there are these teams that knew they weren't contenders going into the year, and they're going to start losing games, and they'll have the excuse that even though they're not super far out of the race, like, they were never supposed to contend. And that's why a guy like Braun makes sense to me.
Kemp makes sense.
Braun, Kemp, Gonzalez eventually. But again, that ownership is weird, so I don't know about that team.
And I'm looking at... Yeah. I was looking at Milwaukee, but yeah, they're other than Braun, they're
right. No, the thing is, a lot of the teams that are definitively bad have completely cleared house already.
Well, and that's why I'm saying the Reds. Like, even though they're 5-2, let's be serious, they're really not going to be going anywhere in that division. Even not in that division. I mean, they're in the middle of a total rebuild.
They're awful. Like.
This is just like a little fluky thing that's happening, and in a couple weeks we're going to be like, "Oh yeah, remember when the Reds were 5-2?" Like,
yeah,
that's true. But like, let's say it's not beyond, because I never bought that the Reds were the 100 loss team that some people projected them to be. I think of them as
way to throw shade, Nick. I totally projected them to be a 100 loss team.
Like some people, freaking cat, everybody, cat can't hear me, but everybody, it's cat. But like USA Today or whatever the hell it is, project them to lose like 100 games. I think of them as like an ordinary bad team, like the 2015 White Sox or whatever. It's like a 72 win team or something like that. Like, it's real bad. I'm not saying they're good, but like, I just don't see 100 loss teams having players like Joey Votto and Raisel Iglesias. I just don't like.
Raisel Iglesias isn't good though.
Yeah, he's not that good.
Joey Votto is though. So let's not.
Oh, Joey Votto is.
How about a team that like 100 losses is a freaking lot, man. Like teams that have Joey Votto and start out 5-2.
Yeah, but they're also.
It is. What they lose 68 games last year or something like that.
This is super nitpicky. It's super nitpicky. I'm talking about the difference between 65 and 75. Like, who cares? They're gonna suck. But if it's totally plausible that already at 5-2. That they go to 8-5, or that they go to 12-8, or like,
or they're eight. Like, they're
what
like,
if they go to, what if they go to 20-12? Like,
okay, Nick, what are you smoking over there?
What I'm trying to say is that if they all they have to do is delay until the point where they have to sell because they have a reason to market this team as a competitor,
especially like, for a guy like Bruce who really needs to rebuild his value. Like, they need Bruce to rebuild his value. They're probably going to be late on trading Bruce. So, and that's exactly the only guy you want, because they're not trading Joey Votto. And
no.
If they are trading Joey Votto, the Sox aren't the kind of team that acquires a Joey Votto.
No, so I'm not trying to say there's any sustainable value with it. I'm saying is that they're already off to a fluky good start for them, and they could keep having a fluky good start, and that delays them releasing guys that the White Sox would be interested in.
And again, like, it hurts that they're like all the teams that are definitive non-contenders have already basically got rid of their dead weight, other than guys like who are very expensive, like Braun and Kemp. So you're not going to be able to get think back to 2000. It was 2009 when the Sox acquired Peavy, right?
I believe so.
And that first trade was original. Like, it was at the deadline.
Was that
2008? No, it wasn't.
You're right. Never mind.
Though they got him at the deadline, the first time they agreed upon the trade was like in mid-May, because the Padres realized, okay, we're not contenders. Let's trade Jake Peavy, who was a former Cy Young winner. But there aren't teams like that who are going to be definitively out of the race and have guys you actually want, because the Reds already traded Frazier and they traded Chapman. The Braves already traded everything you want. They traded Simmons. They're not going to trade Freeman.
I guess Ibar could be better than what we have.
True, and same with Ender and Ciara today, but he probably costs something real.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Ibar you might be able to get for a pittance, but yeah, point taken. Continue, sorry.
So those teams, like the teams that are going to be very clearly out of it very early aren't the teams that you have, like, that you want players from, because all their good players are gone. So you really have to wait. Like, the way the trade market has developed in recent years is you have to wait till July 31st when the Tigers are like, oh fuck, we are terrible, let's trade David Price and Yoenis Cespedes. And because you need to wait, that really hurts the White Sox, unless they're really willing to spend money to fix their Avi problem, because there's not going to be, again, other than your Bronze and your Kemps and your Gonzalez, Bruce's, your expensive players, there's not going to be guys who are just out there in May.
Ironically, though, there is an advantage, and I do want to wrap things up. There is an advantage to how bad Avisail is and how bad possibly shortstop might be, where you might not need like a deal breaker type person to make a significant upgrade where like for example, if the Pirates are willing to part with like Matt Joyce, like who they ran out as their freaking leadoff man slash DH today, because they have John Jay, so one of the dudes like you don't need a huge guy to be a huge upgrade on Abascal if Abascal is going to be a sub replacement level bat at DH. Like you could grab something from someone who's a spare part if they need a reliever, if they need like, I don't know, like, and this is off the top of my head, like throw like Zach Putnam at them or something. You're like, who cares? I don't know. But,
I think the Sox think that, Zach Putnam is really bad.
Or whatever, or like Petrichka, or
time Petrichka, for right or, now, but
I don't, whoever it is. But I do think there is an opportunity in just how bad I think Abascal is.
Right, I think Markakis.
Yeah. I mean, if Markakis gets on base at a .330 clip, I know we've talked about the number before, but that's something he's been capable of.
Yeah, so. He has been
capable of that. Then he actually was okay last year. He's a
career .360 on base guy. He doesn't slug at all, but you know.
Yeah, but he's an on base guy. Yeah.
Yep, and you could put him in left and Melky at DH or whatever it is.
Right. All right.
So
Melvin Upton from the Padres and move Melky to DH and have that elite defensive outfield we talked about. So like even that's an upgrade.
So the White Sox are in first place. We're gonna say I think we're
tied now.
We're gonna have to say goodnight.
They're tied now, though. Despite walking two Astros, Wade Davis finished the game.
So closing thoughts. Ethan, what do you have any remarks, anything we haven't touched on yet?
No, I just think that, I mean, this is as good as a start as they could have possibly gotten out to, and I think that they have enough talent, and I do think that they will use the trade capital that they have, that I think that this team could very conceivably be a contender to the end and very possibly be a division winner.
Kat, yeah. What do you want to, make any closing remarks
yourself? This conversation has been very enlightening, realizing how bad Avi is, but also realizing that, like we were just saying, it could be used to the White Sox advantage. That's something I didn't really think about very much until just now.
One of the crappy insights I have where I go to this well all the time where I pick an area where the White Sox are superlatively weak and then point out where, hey, if we got somebody who, you know, can stand upright without puking all over himself, he's a huge advantage. So, but given that low bar that they have never, there have been many times where they haven't cleared that low bar before. So we're not out of the woods yet, ladies and gentlemen. But, hey, I have thought that this is the best team they've had in a number of years. I actually didn't think that the 2012 team was that great. I thought that they performed as well as could have been expected. And 5-2, I mean, fantastic. So if they can figure out some way to solve the Abascal problem, I am. I think I'm ready to go all gears forward, all speed ahead. Ethan, is there an idiom for what I'm trying to say? Regardless,
why am I the? I'm the
I was like,
person.
Why did you just go to him?
Kat, thoughts?
I mean, I don't have anything. I was just wondering.
Neither of you. All right, so you know you're offended, but
I'm not offended. I was just curious.
Okay, I hope you're both insulted, and none of us had anything productive to say. And onwards to all right. Last thing before I hit the end button. How many games before the Twins win a game? Kat?
I'm going to go with like 2.
I think they beat Leos.
So you're going... So yeah, Ethan says 1-8, and Kat says... Because they're 0-7 right now.
I'm going to say... I don't know. I don't like making these predictions. I don't. Don't make me do it.
0-162. You heard it here first, everyone. Good night.